tracts of land, and the work was done by Negro slaves bought in Africa. They were very badly treated. Further north it was different. It is less hot, and the climate is more like our own. So there you found farms and towns, not unlike those the British emigrants had left behind them, only on a much larger scale. They didn't need slaves, because it was easier and cheaper to do the work themselves. And so the townsfolk of the northern states, who were mostly pious Christians, thought it shameful that the Confederation, founded in accordance with the principles of human rights, should keep slaves as people had in pagan antiquity. The southern states explained that they needed Negro slaves, because without them they would be ruined. No white man, they said, could endure working in such heat, and, in any case, Negroes weren't born to be free, and so on and so forth. In 1820, a compromise was reached. The states which lay to the south of an agreed line would keep slaves, those to the north would not. In the long run, however, the shame of an economy based on slave labor was intolerable. And yet it seemed that little could be done. The southern states, with their huge plantations, were far stronger and richer than the northern farmlands, and were determined not to give in at any cost. But they met their match in President Abraham Lincoln. He was a man with no ordinary destiny. He grew up as a simple farm boy in the backwoods, fought in 1832 in a war against an Indian chief called Black Hawk, and became the postmaster of a small town. There, in his spare time, he studied law, before becoming a lawyer and a member of Parliament. As such, he fought against slavery and made himself thoroughly hated by the plantation owners of the southern states. Despite this, he was elected president in 1861. The southern states immediately declared themselves independent of the United States and founded their own Confederation of Slave States. 75,000 volunteers made themselves available to Lincoln straight away. Despite this, the outlook was very bad for the northerners. Britain, which had abolished and condemned slave labor in its own colonies for several decades, was nevertheless supporting the slave states. There was a frightful and bloody civil war. Yet in the end, the northerners' bravery and tenacity prevailed, and in 1865 Lincoln was able to enter the capital of the southern states to the cheers of liberated slaves. 11 days later, while at the theater, he was murdered by a southerner. But his work was done. The reunited, free United States of America soon became the richest and most powerful country in the world. And it even seems to manage without slaves. Chapter 38. Two New States in Europe. I have known many people who were children at a time before either Germany or Italy existed. It seems incredible, doesn't it, that these great and powerful nations which play such an important role aren't old at all. After the revolutions of 1848, when new railway lines were being built all over Europe and telegraph cables were being laid, when the towns which had turned into factory towns were expanding and many peasants were being drawn into them, and when men had taken to wearing top hats and funny pince-nez spectacles with dangling black cords, the Europe we know was still no more than a patchwork of tiny duchies, kingdoms, principalities, and republics, linked to one another by complicated ties of allegiance or enmity. In this Europe, if we ignore Britain, which was at this time more concerned with its colonies in America, India, and Australia than with the neighbouring continent, there were three important powers. In the centre of Europe stood the Empire of Austria. There the Emperor Franz Joseph had been ruling from the Imperial Palace in Vienna since 1848. I saw him once myself, when I was a little boy. He was by then an old man, and was crossing the park at the Palace of Schönbrunn. I also have a very clear memory of his state funeral. He really was what an emperor was meant to be. He ruled over all sorts of different peoples and countries. He was emperor of Austria, but he was also king of Hungary and count elevated to the rank of prince of the Tyrol, and had lots of other ancient titles, such as king of Jerusalem and protector of the sacred tomb, a title that went back to the Crusades. Many provinces of Italy came under his authority, while others were ruled by members of his family. Then there were the Croats, the Serbs, the Czechs, the Slovenes, the Slovaks, the Poles, and innumerable other peoples. For this reason, the words on old Austrian banknotes, for example, 10 crowns, also appeared in all these other languages. The Emperor of Austria even had some power, at least in name, in the German principalities. But the situation there was rather complicated. When Napoleon shattered the last remnants of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation in 1806, the German Empire had ceased to exist. The many German-speaking lands, which included Prussia, Bavaria, Saxony, Hanover, Frankfurt, Brunswick, and so on and so forth, then formed an association, known as the German Confederation, to which Austria also belonged. All in all, it was a remarkably confusing picture, this German Confederation. Each speck of land had its own prince, its own money, its own stamps, and its own official uniform. It was bad enough when it took several days to get from Berlin to Munich by mail coach, but now that the same journey took less than a day by train, it had become almost unendurable. The patchwork presented by the lands of Germany, Austria, and Italy was quite unlike anything around them on the map. To the west was France. Shortly after the Revolution of 1848, it had once again become an empire. One of Napoleon's descendants had been able to reawaken memories of the glory of the past, and although far from great himself, he was first elected President of the Republic and soon afterwards Emperor of France, under the name of Napoleon III. Despite all its wars and revolutions, France was now an exceptionally rich and powerful country, with great industrial cities. To the east was Russia. The Tsar was not loved in that mighty land. You must bear in mind that by this time many Russians had studied at universities in France and Germany, and their outlook was quite modern and up-to-date. But the Russian Empire and its officials were still living in the Middle Ages. Just think, it was only in 1861 that serfdom was formally abolished, and then, for the first time, 23 million Russian peasants were promised an existence worthy of human dignity. Making promises is one thing, but keeping them is another. In Russia, generally speaking, government was by the lash, or the knout, as it was called. The penalty for speaking freely, for expressing even the mildest opinion, was exile to Siberia, at the very least. Consequently, students and members of the middle classes who had received a modern education detested the Tsar so much that he lived in constant fear of assassination. This was, in fact, the fate of most Tsars, however hard they tried to guard against it. Beside the immensity of Russia and the battle-hardened might of France, it seemed impossible for any other country to make itself heard in Europe. With the loss of its Latin American colonies, beginning in 1810, Spain had become weak and powerless. Turkey, no longer in control of its European possessions, was now referred to in the newspapers as the sick man of Europe. Its various Christian subject peoples had been fighting for their liberty with the enthusiastic support of the rest of Europe. The Greeks were first, followed by the Bulgarians, the Romanians, and the Albanians, while Russia, France, and Austria fought over the rest of Turkey's European possessions and Constantinople. This was just as well for Turkey, for none of those three countries was willing to surrender such a rich prize to any of the others. So Constantinople stayed Turkish. Meanwhile, France and Austria were still fighting over the Italian dominions, as they had been for hundreds of years. But times had changed. Italians had also been brought closer to one another by their railways, and, like the inhabitants of German towns, they too had come to realize that they weren't simply Florentines, Genoese, Venetians, or Neapolitans. They were all Italians, and they wished to decide their own fate. At that time, there was only one small state in northern Italy that was free and independent. It lay at the foot of the mountains over which Hannibal had once come, and was called Piedmont, which means exactly that, foot of the mountains. Now Piedmont and the island of Sardinia together formed a small but strong kingdom under one ruler, King Victor Emmanuel, and he had an exceptionally able and wily minister called Camillo Cavour, who knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted what all Italians had been yearning for, and what so many of them had shed their blood for in bold but often ill-conceived and perilous adventures, both during and after the 1848 revolution, a unified Italian kingdom. Cavour himself was no warrior. He had no faith in the secret conspiracies and risky surprise attacks favoured by a brave dreamer called Garibaldi and his young fellow fighters in their efforts to win their country's freedom. Cavour was looking for a different and more effective way, and he found one. He managed to persuade the ambitious emperor of the French, Napoleon III, that he should join in the struggle for Italian freedom and unity. He encouraged him to think that if he did so, he had everything to gain and nothing to lose. For by involving himself in the struggle for freedom of a country that didn't belong to him, he could only harm Austria through its possessions in Italy, a prospect which did not altogether displease him. At the same time, being the champion of liberty would make him the hero of a great European nation, and this, too, was a tempting thought. Thanks, then, to Cavour's cunning diplomacy and to the bold expeditions of the impetuous Garibaldi, and at the cost of a very great number of lives, the Italians achieved their goal. In the two wars they fought against Austria, in 1859 and 1866, the Austrian armies often had the upper hand. But as a result of interventions by Napoleon III and the Tsar, the Emperor Franz Joseph was finally forced to give up his Italian territories. Elsewhere everyone had cast their votes, and the results showed that the whole population wanted to belong to Italy. So the various dukes abdicated. By 1866, Italy was unified. Only one state was lacking, and this was the capital, Rome. But Rome belonged to the Pope, and Napoleon III refused to hand the city over to the Italians for fear of falling out with him. He defended the city with French troops and repelled a number of attacks by Garibaldi's volunteers. In 1866, Austria's stubborn determination might yet have ended in victory if Cavour hadn't cleverly arranged an enemy for Austria with similar intentions. This was Prussia, in the north, whose prime minister at the time was Bismarck. Bismarck was a noble landowner from North Germany. He was a man of exceptional intelligence, with a will of iron. He never lost sight of his goal, and wasn't in the least bit shy of telling even King William I of Prussia exactly what he thought. From the outset, Bismarck wanted just one thing, to make Prussia mighty, and use its strength to make one great German empire out of the jumbled patchwork of the German Confederation. For this, he was convinced it was vital to have a strong and powerful army. Indeed, it was he who famously said that the great questions of history are decided not by speeches, but by blood and iron. I don't know whether that's always true, but in his case history proved him right. The Prussian representatives were unwilling to grant him the great sum he needed for this army out of the people's taxes, so in 1862 he persuaded the king to rule against the constitution and the will of Parliament. The king feared he would suffer the same fate as King Charles I of England when he failed to keep his word, and Louis XVI of France. He was travelling with Bismarck in a railway carriage and turned to him and said, "I can see exactly where all this is leading, down to Opera House Square, where they'll chop off your head beneath my windows, and then it will be my turn." Bismarck merely said, "And then?" "Well, then we shall be dead," replied the king. "True," said Bismarck, "then we'll be dead. But what better death could we have?" And so it came about that, against the will of the people, a great army was equipped with a large number of guns and cannons, and was soon proving its worth against Denmark. With these exceedingly well-armed and well-trained forces, Bismarck attacked Austria in 1866, while the Italians were attacking from the south. His aim was to force the emperor out of the German Confederation, leaving Prussia as its most powerful member. Prussia could then lead Germany. At Königgrätz in Bohemia, he defeated the Austrians decisively in a bloody battle. The Emperor Franz Joseph had to give in, and Austria left the Confederation. Bismarck didn't press his victory too far and made no further demands. This incensed the generals and officers of the Prussian army, but Bismarck wouldn't budge. He had no wish to make a lasting enemy of Austria. But, without telling anyone, he made secret pacts with all the other German states, ensuring their support in any war Prussia chose to undertake. Meanwhile, in France, the growth of Prussian military power was making Napoleon III increasingly uneasy. He had just lost an utterly unnecessary war in Mexico in 1867, and was fearful of this well-armed neighbour across the Rhine. In any case, the French had never felt comfortable with any growth in German military might. King William of Prussia was staying at a hot spring resort at Ems when Napoleon III's ambassador interrupted his cure with the most extraordinary demand. On behalf of himself and his descendants, the king was to renounce in writing claims that he had never even made. Without the king's agreement, Bismarck then seized the opportunity to force Napoleon III to declare war. Against the expectations of the French, all the German states joined in, and it was soon clear that the German troops were better equipped and better led than the French. At a place called Sedan, the Germans captured a large part of the French army, which happened to include Napoleon III. They hurried on towards Paris, where they laid siege to the well-defended city for months. The defeat of France meant that the French troops in charge of the Pope's protection had to leave Rome, and this allowed the King of Italy to make his entry. It was all very complicated. Meanwhile, during the siege, Bismarck persuaded the various German kings and princes to propose to the King of Prussia, who was staying at Versailles, that he accept the title of German Emperor. You won't believe what happened next. King William insisted on being called Emperor of Germany and not German Emperor, and the whole thing nearly fell through. Finally, however, in the great gallery of mirrors at Versailles, the creation of the German Empire was solemnly proclaimed. But the newly appointed emperor, William I, was incensed at not having the title he had wanted. In full view of everyone, shockingly and intentionally, he strode past Bismarck, refusing to shake the hand of the empire's founder. Despite this, Bismarck continued to serve him, and served him well. In Paris, during the months of the siege, a dreadful and bloody workers' revolt had broken out, which was later suppressed with even greater bloodshed. More people died in it than in the whole of the French Revolution. For a while afterwards, France was powerless, and the French were forced to make peace. They had to hand over a large part of their country to Germany, Alsace and Lorraine, together with a large sum of money. Because he had ruled so badly, the French dismissed Napoleon III and founded a republic. They had had enough of emperors and kings, and they wouldn't ever have any again. Bismarck was now Chancellor, or Prime Minister, of the unified German Empire, and he governed with great authority. He was a fierce opponent of the sort of socialist action recommended by Karl Marx, but he knew about the appalling conditions of the workers. He believed the only way to stop the spread of Marx's teachings was to allay the worst hardships of the workers, so that they no longer wanted to turn the whole state upside down. So he created organizations to give support to workers who were sick or had had accidents, who would otherwise have died from lack of assistance, and did his best to ensure that the worst poverty was reduced. Even so, all workers in those days still had to work a 12-hour day, including Sundays. Prince Bismarck, with his bushy eyebrows and his stern and resolute expression, was soon one of the best-known men in Europe. Even his enemies agreed that he was a great statesman. When the peoples of Europe wanted to set about dividing up the world, which was now so much smaller, they met together in Berlin in 1878, and Bismarck led the discussions. But when a new German emperor came along, the two were constantly at odds. After many disagreements with his chancellor, William II could stand it no longer and dismissed him. Bismarck, now an old man, retired to his ancestral estate. There he lived for several more years, sending messages to the new leaders of the German government to warn them of the blunders they were making. Chapter 39. Dividing Up the World. And now we are coming to the time when my parents were young. They were able to tell me exactly what things were like, how more and more homes came first to have gas and then electric lighting, and then a telephone, while in the towns electric tramways appeared, soon to be followed by cars, how vast suburbs spread to house the workers, and factories with powerful machines kept thousands busy doing work which used to be done by perhaps hundreds of thousands of artisans. But whatever happened to all those textiles, shoes, tins of food, and pots and pans that were turned out every day in wagon loads by these great factories? A certain amount, of course, could be sold at home. People who had jobs could soon afford many more clothes and shoes than artisans used to own. And everything was infinitely cheaper, even if it didn't last as long, so people had to keep buying replacements. But, of course, they didn't earn enough to buy all the things the monstrous new machines produced. And if all those wagon loads of cloth and leather just sat around unsold, it was pointless for the factory to keep on producing more. It had to close down. But if it did, the workers lost their jobs and were no longer able to buy anything, and even less was sold. This sort of situation is called an economic crisis. And to make sure it didn't happen, every country needed to sell as much as it possibly could of what its many factories produced. If it was unsuccessful at home, it had to try to sell its goods abroad. Not only in Europe, where there were factories just about everywhere, but in countries where there weren't any, countries where there were people who didn't yet have clothes or shoes. In Africa, for example. And so, all of a sudden, the industrialized countries found themselves falling over each other in a race to get to remote and wild places. The wilder they were, the better. They needed them not only so they could sell their goods, but also because those places often had things that their own countries didn't have, such as cotton for making cloth and oil for petrol. But there again, the more of these so-called raw materials they brought from the colonies to Europe, the more the factories were able to produce, and the more eager was their search for places where there were still people who would buy their vast output. People who were unable to find work in their own countries could now emigrate to these foreign places. In short, it became vitally important for the countries of Europe to own colonies. No one bothered to ask the native inhabitants what they thought about it, and, as you can imagine, they were often very badly treated if any of them tried shooting at the invading troops with their bows and arrows. Of course, the British did best in this division of the world. After all, they had had possessions in India, Australia, and North America for several centuries, and colonies in Africa, where their influence in Egypt was particularly strong. The French had also started early, and by now owned a large part of Indochina and several parts of Africa, among them the Sahara Desert, more impressive perhaps on account of its size than for any other reason. The Russians had no colonies overseas, but their own empire was vast, and they didn't yet have many factories. They wanted to extend their grasp across Asia as far as the sea and trade from there. But their way was barred by those good students of the Europeans, the Japanese, who said, "Stop." In a dreadful war that broke out between Russia and Japan in 1905, the Tsar's mighty empire was defeated and forced to give up some of its territory by tiny new Japan. And now the Japanese also began building more and more new factories for themselves, and they too needed foreign lands, not only to sell their goods, but because there wasn't enough room for them all in their tiny island kingdom. Naturally enough, last in line for the share-out were the new states, Italy and Germany. While they had been fragmented, they had been in no position to conquer lands overseas. Now they wanted to make up for centuries of lost opportunities. After much fighting, Italy obtained some narrow strips of land in Africa. Germany was stronger and had more factories, so its needs were greater. And in time, Bismarck succeeded in acquiring several larger stretches of land for Germany, mainly in Africa, together with some islands in the Pacific. But because of the way the whole thing works, you can never have enough land. More colonies means more factories means more goods, and more goods means that even more colonies are needed. The demand isn't driven by ambition or the lust for power, but by a genuine need. But now the world had been shared out. To create new colonies, or merely to prevent the old ones being snatched from them by stronger neighbors, it was necessary to fight, or at least to threaten to do so. So each state raised powerful armies and navies and kept on saying, "Attack me if you dare." The countries that had been powerful for centuries felt they had a right to be so. But when the new German Empire and its excellent factories entered the game, built a great navy and tried to win more and more influence in Asia and Africa, the others took it very badly. And because everyone knew that sooner or later there was bound to be a fearful conflict, they all went on expanding their armies and building bigger and bigger battleships. When war finally did break out, however, it wasn't where it had been expected all those years, nor was it on account of some dispute in Africa or Asia. It was caused by another country, the only great state in Europe to have no colonies at all, Austria. That ancient empire, with its mosaic of peoples, wasn't interested in conquering far-off lands on the other side of the world. But it did need people to buy the goods made in its factories. So, just as it had done since the wars with Turkey, Austria kept on trying to acquire new lands towards the east, lands only recently liberated from Turkish rule, where there weren't yet any factories. But these small populations of newly liberated eastern peoples, such as the Serbs, were frightened of the great empire and didn't want it to reach out any further. When, in the spring of 1914, the heir to the Austrian throne was visiting one of these newly conquered regions called Bosnia, he was murdered by a Serb in the capital, Sarajevo. Austria's generals and politicians thought at the time that a war with Serbia was inevitable. The dreadful murder had to be avenged and Serbia humbled. Frightened by Austria's advance, Russia was drawn in, whereupon Germany, as Austria's ally, also became involved. And once Germany was in the war, all the ancient enmities were unleashed. The Germans wanted to begin by destroying France, their most dangerous enemy, so they marched straight across neutral Belgium to attack Paris. Britain, fearing that a German victory would make Germany all-powerful, now joined in as well. Soon the whole world was at war with Germany and Austria, and the two countries found themselves surrounded by the armies of the Entente, meaning their allied enemies, those who had an understanding with one another. Germany and Austria, in the middle, were known as the Central Powers. The gigantic Russian armies pressed forward, but were brought to a standstill after a few months. The world has never seen a war like it. Millions and millions of people marched against each other. Even Africans and Indians had to fight. The German armies were stopped when they reached the River Marne, not far from Paris. From this moment on, real battles, in the old sense, would only very rarely be fought. Instead, giant armies dug themselves in and made their camps in endlessly long trenches facing one another. Then, for days on end, they fired thousands of guns at each other, bursting out in assaults through barricades of barbed wire and blown-up trenches, across a scorched and devastated wasteland strewn with corpses. In 1915, Italy also declared war on Austria, despite having originally been its ally. Now people fought in the snow and ice of the mountains of the Tyrol, and the famous exploits of Hannibal's warriors during their crossing of the Alps seemed like child's play compared with the courage and endurance shown by these simple soldiers. People fought each other in the skies, in aeroplanes. They dropped bombs on peaceful towns, sank innocent ships, and fought on the sea and under the sea, just as Leonardo da Vinci had foreseen. People invented horrible weapons that murdered and mutilated thousands each day, the most terrible of which were gases that poisoned the air. Anyone who breathed them died in terrible agony. These gases were either released and carried to the enemy soldiers on the wind, or fired in the form of grenades, which released their poison when they exploded. People built armored cars and tanks, which moved slowly and inexorably over ditches and walls, demolishing and crushing everything in their path. The people of Germany and Austria were destitute. For a long time there was hardly anything to eat, no clothes, no coal, and no light. Women had to queue for hours in the cold to buy the smallest piece of bread or a half-rotten potato. But just once there was a glimmer of hope. In Russia, a revolution had broken out in 1917. The Tsar had abdicated, but the bourgeois government which followed wanted to continue with the war. However, the people were against it. So there was a second great uprising in which the factory workers, under the guidance of their leader Lenin, seized power. They shared out the farmland among the peasants, confiscated the property of the rich and the nobility, and tried to rule the empire according to the principles of Karl Marx. Then the outside world intervened, and in the fearful battles that followed, millions more people died. Lenin's successors continued to rule Russia for many years. The Germans were able to recall some of their troops from the Eastern Front, but this didn't help them much because new, fresh soldiers now attacked them from the west. The Americans had decided to step in. Nevertheless, the Germans and Austrians held out for more than a year against overwhelming odds. By putting all their efforts into a last desperate attempt in the West, they very nearly won. In the end, however, they were exhausted. And when, in 1918, America's President Wilson announced that he wanted a just peace in which each nation would determine its own fate, many of their troops gave up. So Germany and Austria were forced to agree to a ceasefire. Those who had survived returned home to their starving families. The next thing that happened was that revolution broke out in these exhausted countries. The emperors of Germany and Austria abdicated, and the various peoples of the Austrian Empire, the Czechs and the Slovaks, the Hungarians, the Poles and the southern Slavs, declared themselves independent and founded individual states. Then, having understood from President Wilson that there was to be a peace treaty, and that negotiations were to be held in the ancient royal palaces of Versailles, Saint-Germain, and the Trianon, Austria, Hungary, and Germany sent envoys to Paris, only to discover that they were excluded from these negotiations. Germany was held chiefly responsible for the war and was to be punished. Not only did the Germans have to surrender all the colonies and lands which they had taken from France in 1870 and pay vast sums of money to the victors each year, but they even had to sign a formal declaration saying that Germany alone was to blame for the war. The Austrians and the Hungarians fared little better. So this was how President Wilson kept his promises. What you have just heard is what I believed to be true when I wrote this account. But listen to my explanation in the final chapter of this book. 11 million people died in that war, and entire regions were devastated in a way that had never been seen before. The suffering was beyond imagination. Mankind had come a long way in its mastery of nature. With the telephone, you can now sit in your room at home and talk about everything or nothing with someone on the other side of the world in Australia. You can tune in on the radio to a concert in London, or a program on raising geese broadcast from Portugal. People build gigantic buildings far higher than the pyramids or St. Peter's Church in Rome. They make great aeroplanes, each one capable of killing more people than the whole of Philip of Spain's invincible armada. Ways have been found to combat the most fearsome diseases. There have been amazing discoveries. People have found formulas for all sorts of things that happen in nature which are so mysterious and so remarkable that few people understand them. But the formulas are correct. The stars move in exactly the way they predict. Every day we know a little more about nature, and about human nature too. But the horror of poverty remains. There are many millions of people on our earth who cannot find work, and every year millions die of starvation. We all hope for a better future. It must be better. Imagine time as a river, and that we are flying high above it in an aeroplane. Far below you can just make out the mountain caves of the mammoth hunters, and the steppes where the first cereals grew. Those distant dots are the pyramids, and the Tower of Babel. In these lowlands the Jews once tended their flocks. This is the sea the Phoenicians sailed across. What looks like a white star shining over there with the sea on either side is in fact the Acropolis, the symbol of Greek art. And there, on the other side of the world, are the great dark forests where the Indian penitents withdrew to meditate, and the Buddha experienced enlightenment. Now we can see the Great Wall of China, and over there the smouldering ruins of Carthage. In those gigantic stone funnels, the Romans watched Christians being torn to pieces by wild beasts. The dark clouds on the horizon are the storm clouds of the migrations, and it was in those forests beside the river that the first monks converted and educated the Germanic tribes. Leaving the deserts over there behind them, the Arabs set out to conquer the world, and this is where Charlemagne ruled. On this hill the fortress still stands where the struggle between the Pope and the Emperor over which of them was to dominate the world was finally decided. We can see castles from the age of chivalry, and, nearer still, cities with beautiful cathedrals. Over there is Florence, and there the new St. Peter's, the cause of Luther's quarrel with the Church. The city of Mexico is on fire. The invincible armada is being wrecked off England's coasts. That dense pall of smoke comes from burning villages and the bonfires on which people were burnt during the 30 Years' War. The magnificent chateau set in a great park is Louis XIV's Palace of Versailles. Here are the Turks encamped outside Vienna, and, nearer still, the simple castles of Frederick the Great and Maria Theresa. In the distance, the cries of liberty, equality, and fraternity reach us from the streets of Paris, and we can already see Moscow burning over there, and the wintry land in which the soldiers of the last conqueror's Grande Armée perished. Getting nearer, we can see smoke rising from factory chimneys and hear the whistle of railway trains. The Peking Summer Palace lies in ruins, and warships are leaving Japanese ports under the flag of the rising sun. Here the guns of the World War are still thundering. Poison gas is drifting across the land. And over there, through the open dome of an observatory, a giant telescope directs the gaze of an astronomer towards unimaginably distant galaxies. But below us and in front of us there is nothing but mist, mist that is dense and impenetrable. All we know is that the river flows onwards. On and on it goes, towards an unknown sea. But now let us quickly drop down in our plane towards the river. From close up, we can see it is a real river, with rippling waves like the sea. A strong wind is blowing, and there are little crests of foam on the waves. Look carefully at the millions of shimmering white bubbles rising and then vanishing with each wave. Over and over again, new bubbles come to the surface and then vanish in time with the waves. For a brief instant they are lifted on the wave's crest, and then they sink down and are seen no more. We are like that. Each one of us no more than a tiny, glimmering thing, a sparkling droplet on the waves of time which flow past beneath us into an unknown, misty future. We leap up, look around us, and, before we know it, we vanish again. We can hardly be seen in the great river of time. New drops keep rising to the surface. And what we call our fate is no more than our struggle in that great multitude of droplets in the rise and fall of one wave. But we must make use of that moment. It is worth the effort. Chapter 40, the last chapter. The small part of the history of the world which I have lived through myself, looking back. It is one thing to learn about history from books, and quite another to experience it oneself. That is what I wanted to remind you of just now, when I likened a glimpse into the past of mankind to the view seen from an aeroplane flying at a great height. All we can make out are a few details on the banks of the river of time. But when seen from close up, with the waves coming towards us one by one, the river looks quite different. Some things are much clearer, while others are barely visible. And that's how I found it. In the last chapter I told you about the terrible World War of 1914-18. Although I lived through it, I was only 9 years old when it ended, so when I wrote about it, I still had to rely on books. In my final chapter, I would like to tell you a little about what I actually did experience. The more I think about it, the stranger it seems. The world is now so utterly different from what it was in 1918. And yet so many of the changes that occurred happened so imperceptibly that we now take them completely for granted. When I was a boy, there were no televisions, no computers, no space flights, and no atomic energy. But it's easy to forget the most important change, and that is that there are so many more people in the world than there were then. Towards the end of the 1914-18 war, there were more than 2 billion people on our planet. Since then, the figure has more than doubled. Of course, numbers as big as that don't mean much to us, because we can't actually picture them to ourselves. But if we bear in mind that a line drawn round the Earth at the level of the equator would measure roughly 40 million meters, and that when people form queues in front of a ticket office there are roughly 2 of them to a meter, it means that 80 million people waiting patiently in a queue would reach all the way around the world. The queue when I was a boy would have gone round 22 times, and today, with our 4,500,000,000 fellow inhabitants, the queue would reach more than 50 times round the earth. Then you must also realize that, throughout the time that the population was multiplying at such a tremendous rate, the globe we all inhabit was imperceptibly growing smaller and smaller. Of course, I don't mean literally shrinking, but technology, and in particular that of flying, kept on reducing the distance between the various parts of the globe. This was also something I experienced myself. Whenever I find myself at an airport and hear a succession of announcements for flights to Delhi, New York, Hong Kong, or Sydney, and see the swarms of people preparing to depart, I can't help thinking of my youth. In those days, people would point at someone and say, "He's been to America," or "She's been to India." Today there are hardly any places in the world that can't be reached in a matter of hours. Even if we don't go to far-off countries ourselves, they seem closer to us than they were in my youth. Whenever a major event happens anywhere in the world, we read about it in the newspapers the next day. We hear about it on the radio and see it on the television news. The inhabitants of ancient Mexico knew nothing about the destruction of Jerusalem, and it is unlikely that anyone in China ever heard of the effects of the 30 Years' War. But by the First World War, things had changed. The very fact that it was known as a world war was because so many nations had been drawn into the fighting. Naturally, that doesn't mean that all the news which now reaches us from all over the world is true. One of the things I also learned was not to believe everything I read in the newspapers. I'll give you an example. Because I had lived through the First World War myself, I thought I could believe everything I had heard about it at the time. That is why the last chapter, Dividing Up the World, is not quite as impartial as I had intended. The role played by America's President Wilson was not at all what I had imagined. I described a situation in which Wilson made promises to the Germans and Austrians which he failed to keep. I firmly believed that what I remembered had to be right. After all, it was part of my own experience. And when I wrote about it later, I just wrote down what everyone believed. But I should have checked my facts, as all historians must be especially careful to do. To cut a long story short, President Wilson did indeed make a peace offer early in 1918, but because Germany and Austria and their allies were still hoping to win the war, they ignored it. Only when the war had dragged on for 10 more months and they had been defeated with very heavy losses were they prepared to accept the president's proposal. But by then it was too late. Quite how serious and regrettable this error of mine was rapidly became apparent. For although I did not foresee it, the fact that all those who had been defeated were convinced that their suffering was the result of a gross deception was very easily exploited and transformed by ambitious and fanatical agitators into a raging thirst for vengeance. I am reluctant to name them, but everyone will know that the one I have most in mind is Adolf Hitler. Hitler had been a soldier in the First World War, and he too remained convinced that, had it not been for the supposed deception, the German army would never have been defeated. But he didn't just blame Wilson. In his eyes, the enemy's propaganda had been crucial in persuading the Germans and Austrians at home to abandon the soldiers at the front to their fate. Hitler was therefore determined to trump the enemy in the art of propaganda. He was a brilliant popular orator and drew huge crowds. He knew there was no better way to incite a mob to action than to give them a scapegoat, someone they could blame for their suffering. And he found one in the Jews. The fate of this ancient people has been touched on several times in this book. I described their voluntary segregation and the loss of their homeland with the destruction of Jerusalem, and their persecution during the Middle Ages. But even though I come from a Jewish family myself, it never entered my head that such horrors might be repeated in my own lifetime. Here I must confess to another error that slipped into this history, but one for which I might perhaps be excused. In chapter 33 it says that a truly new age began, in which people started to turn their minds away from the brutality of earlier times, because the ideas and ideals of the so-called Enlightenment of the 18th century had by then become so widespread that people took them to be self-evident. At the time that I wrote that, it seemed to me inconceivable that anyone might ever again stoop to persecuting people of a different religion, use torture to extract confessions, or question the rights of man. But what seemed unthinkable to me happened all the same. Such a painful step backwards seems almost beyond our understanding, and yet it may be no harder for young people to understand than it is for adults. They need only open their eyes at school. School children are often intolerant. Look how easily they make fun of their teacher if they see him wearing something unfashionable that the class finds amusing. And once respect is lost, all hell breaks loose. And if a fellow student is different in some minor way, in the color of their skin or hair, or the way they speak or eat, they too can become victims of hateful teasing and tormenting, which they just have to put up with. Of course, not all young people are equally cruel or heartless. But no one wants to be a spoilsport, so in one way or another most of them join in the fun, until they hardly recognize themselves. Unfortunately, grown-ups don't behave any better, especially when they have nothing else to do, or are having a hard time, or sometimes when they just think they are having a hard time. They band together with other real or supposed companions in misfortune and take to the streets, marching in step and parroting mindless slogans, filled with their own importance. I myself saw Hitler's brown shirt supporters beating up Jewish students at Vienna University, and when I was writing this book, Hitler had already seized power in Germany. It seemed only a matter of time before the Austrian government would also fall, so I was lucky to be invited to England just in time before Hitler's troops marched into Austria in March 1938. After that, as in Germany, anyone who greeted someone with a simple good morning and not a Heil Hitler was taking a very grave risk. In this type of situation, it soon becomes all too clear that in the eyes of the supporters of this sort of movement there is only one sin, disloyalty to the Führer, or leader, and only one virtue, absolute obedience. To bring victory closer, every order had to be obeyed, even if it ran counter to the laws of humanity. Of course, similar things have happened at earlier times in history, and I have described many of them in this book. For example, when I wrote about Muhammad's first disciples. The Jesuits, too, were said to place obedience above all else. I also touched briefly on the victory of the communists in Russia under Lenin, and there, too, there were convinced communists who would not tolerate any opponents. Their ruthlessness in the pursuit of their goals knew no bounds, and millions died as a result. In the years that followed the First World War, tolerance also vanished in Germany, Italy, and Japan. The politicians of those countries told their fellow countrymen that they had been cheated when the world was shared out, and that they too had the right to rule over other peoples. The Italians were reminded of their ancient Roman ancestry, the Japanese of their warriors, and the Germans of the old Germanic tribes of Charlemagne and Frederick the Great. People, they were told, were not of equal value, just as some breeds of dog were better at hunting than others. They themselves belonged to the best race, the one designed for ruling. I know a wise old Buddhist monk who, in a speech to his fellow countrymen, once said he'd love to know why someone who boasts that he is the cleverest, the strongest, the bravest, or the most gifted man on earth is thought ridiculous and embarrassing. Whereas if, instead of I, he says, we are the most intelligent, the strongest, the bravest, and the most gifted people on earth, his fellow countrymen applaud enthusiastically and call him a patriot. For there is nothing patriotic about it. One can be attached to one's own country without needing to insist that the rest of the world's inhabitants are worthless. But as more and more people were taken in by this sort of nonsense, the menace to peace grew greater. Then, when a serious economic crisis in Germany condemned vast numbers of people to unemployment, war seemed the simplest way out. The unemployed would become soldiers or work in the armaments factories, and in this way the hateful treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain would be wiped off the face of the earth. Not only that, but the Western democratic countries, France, Britain, and the United States, had become so softened by years of peace, or so it was thought, that they were hardly likely to defend themselves. Certainly no one there wanted a war, and every effort was made to avoid giving Hitler an excuse to bring calamity down on the world. But, sadly, a pretext can always be found, and, if need be, incidents can be arranged. So on the first day of September in 1939, the German army marched into Poland. By that time I was already in England and witnessed for myself the profound sadness, but also the determination of those who had to march off to war again. This time there were no cheerful battle songs and no dreams of glory. They were just doing their duty, for the madness had to be stopped. My task was to listen to German broadcasts and translate them into English so as to know what German listeners were being told and what they were not being told. This meant that from 1939 to 1945 I was in the curious position of living through all 6 years of that terrible war on both sides, as it were, if in very different ways. At home in England I saw determination, but also hardship, anxiety for the men at the front, the effects of air raids and fear at the turns the war was taking. From German radio broadcasts, all I heard were cries of triumph and outpourings of abuse. Hitler believed in the power of propaganda, a faith which seemed justified when the successes of the first 2 years of the war exceeded even his wildest expectations. Poland, Denmark and Norway, Holland and Belgium, France, large parts of Russia and the Balkans were overrun, and only Britain, that little island on the edge of Europe, still held out. And even that resistance could surely not last long, for to the sound of trumpet fanfares, the German radio ceaselessly proclaimed how many ships carrying supplies and armaments intended for the British had been sunk by their U-boats. But when, without any declaration of war, in December 1941, the Japanese attacked the American fleet at anchor in Pearl Harbor and virtually destroyed it, and Hitler took it upon himself to declare war on the United States, and when, In the autumn of 1942, the German troops were beaten back in North Africa and defeated by the Russians in January 1943 outside Stalingrad, and when the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, proved powerless to prevent the Allies' devastating bombardments of German towns, it became clear that it takes more than fine words and fanfares to win a war. When Winston Churchill became Prime Minister in England, at a time when the outlook was grim, he said, "I can promise nothing but blood, sweat, and tears." And it was precisely because he had said that that we also believed him when he held out a glimmer of hope. How many German listeners paid any attention to the justifications and promises that I heard day in, day out on the German radio is anyone's guess. What I do know is that neither the German listeners nor we ourselves were aware at the time of the most horrifying of all the crimes committed by the Germans during the war. In connection with this, I shall, if you don't mind, take you back to where I said, speaking of the Spanish conquistadores of Mexico, "There and in other parts of America, they set about exterminating the ancient, cultivated Indian peoples in the most horrendous way. This chapter in the history of mankind is so appalling and so shameful to us Europeans," I wrote, "that I would rather not say anything more about it. I am even more reluctant to talk about the monstrous crime that was committed in our own century. After all, this book is intended for young readers who should not have to read about such things. But children grow up, too, and they too must learn from history how easy it is for human beings to be transformed into inhuman beings through incitement and intolerance. And so it came about that, in the last years of the Second World War, the Jewish inhabitants of every country in Europe under German occupation, millions of men, women, and children, were driven from their home countries. Most were put on trains and sent eastwards, where they were murdered. As I said before, the German radio said nothing about any of this to its listeners, and like many others, I couldn't at first bring myself to believe it when the war ended and the unthinkable became known in 1945. But sadly, there is abundant proof of this monstrous crime, and although many years have already passed since it was committed, it is of the utmost importance that it should not be forgotten or hushed up. With the mingling of peoples on our tiny planet, it becomes more and more necessary for us to respect and tolerate each other, not least because technological advances are bringing us closer and closer together. The impact of technology was also demonstrated in the Second World War, when the almost inexhaustible reserves of the American arms industry, which benefited both Britain and Russia, made the outcome inevitable. Despite the desperate resistance put up by the German soldiers, the British and Americans were able to land on the French coast of Normandy in the summer of 1944 and drive the Germans back. At the same time, the Russians were pursuing a by now unresisting German army, and in April they finally reached Berlin, where Hitler took his own life. There was no talk of a peace treaty this time. The victors remained in Germany as occupying forces, and for decades a heavily guarded frontier ran right through Germany, separating the sphere of influence of communist Russia from that of the Western democracies. However, with the defeat of Germany, the World War was still not over, for the Japanese, who had meanwhile conquered large parts of Asia, were far from defeated. And because no end was in sight, the Americans brought out an entirely new weapon, the atomic bomb. It so happened that, shortly before war broke out, I had met a young physicist who told me about an article published by the great Danish scientist Niels Bohr. Its subject was the theoretical possibility of constructing a uranium bomb, whose destructive power would far exceed that of any known explosive. At the time, we were both united in hoping that such a weapon might only be dropped on some desert island, to show friend and foe alike that all other ideas of weaponry and warfare had had their day. Although many of the scientists who were working frantically throughout the war to realize this weapon certainly felt as we did, our hope was in vain. In August 1945, the Japanese towns of Hiroshima and Nagasaki became the first victims of an unimaginable catastrophe, and Japan was finally defeated. It was clear to all of us that with this invention an entirely new chapter in the history of the world had begun, for the discovery of atomic energy might be likened to the discovery of fire. Fire, too, can warm, and it can destroy, but its destructive power is nothing next to that of today's even greater atomic weapons. One can only hope that this development has made it impossible for such weapons to be used ever again against human beings. It must be clear to everyone that if they were to be used, neither side would be likely to survive, and vast areas of the globe would be turned into uninhabitable deserts. Of course, the world has changed enormously since the last war. The inhabitants of whole continents that belong to the British Empire have since then become largely independent, although, unfortunately, not yet any more peaceable for it. Yet despite the brutal conflicts and worrying crises that have broken out since 1945 in various parts of the globe, we have been spared a third world war, because we all know only too well that it could mean the end of the history of the world. It isn't a great comfort, but it's better than none at all. Not surprisingly, this entirely new situation in human history led many to condemn out of hand all the achievements of a science that had brought us to the edge of the abyss. And yet those people should not forget that, without science and technology, it would not have been possible for the countries concerned to make good, at least in part, the damage and destruction caused by the World War, so that life could return to normal much earlier than anyone had dared to hope. Finally, I should like to make one more small correction to my book, to make good an omission that lies close to my heart. My chapter, Men and Machines, is not exactly incorrect, but it is a little one-sided. While it is indeed true that the switch from artisans and craftsmen to factories and machines entailed a great deal of suffering, I should nevertheless have mentioned that without the new techniques of mass production, it would have been quite impossible to feed, clothe, and house the steadily increasing population. The very fact that more and more children were being born, and fewer of them were dying soon after, was largely due to the scientific advance of medicine, which insisted on such things as piped running water and proper sewerage. True, the growing industrialization of Europe, America, and of Japan has meant the loss of much that is beautiful, but we must not forget how many blessings, and I mean blessings, it has brought us. I well remember what people meant in my youth when they talked about the poor. It was not only the destitute, the beggars, and the homeless who looked different from the middle-class inhabitants of large towns, but factory workers, too, both men and women, could be recognized at a distance by their dress. The women usually wore shawls on their heads against the cold, and no factory worker would ever have dreamed of wearing a white shirt, for it would have instantly shown the dirt. And when I think about it, I remember people used to talk about the smell of the poor, because the majority of a town's inhabitants lived in poorly ventilated tenements with, at most, a single tap at the foot of the stairs. A middle-class household, and not just the wealthy ones, usually included a cook, a parlour-maid, and often a nursery-maid to take care of the children as well. Such women often had a better life than they would have had if they had stayed at home, but it can't have been very pleasant, for example, to have had only one day a week when you were allowed out, and to be generally looked upon as a servant. It was during my childhood that people were just beginning to think about such things, and after the First World War, servants became officially known as home helps. Even so, when I visited Berlin as a student, houses often had a sign at the entrance which read, "Entrance for gentlemen and ladies only." Even in those days this made me feel uncomfortable. Servants and tradesmen had to use the back stairs, and weren't allowed to use the lift, even if they had a heavy load to carry. Thankfully, all that is over now, like a bad dream. To be sure, life is still hard for many people, and there are wretched and joyless neighborhoods in the towns of Europe and America. But most people who work in factories, and even most of the unemployed, live better today than many medieval knights must have done in their castles. They eat better, and above all they are healthier, and, as a rule, live longer, which was not the case only a short while ago. Since time began, people have dreamed of a golden age, and now that something close to one is true for so many, no one is willing to admit it. But the same could not be said of those countries in Eastern Europe which were forced by Russia's armies to adopt the communist system. It was especially hard for the inhabitants of East Germany, who, as the years went by, saw how much better the lives of their Western neighbors were, until the day came when they were no longer prepared to make the heavy sacrifices that the communist system of economics demanded. And so, in 1989, quite unexpectedly, the unthinkable happened. The East Germans succeeded in forcing open their border, and both parts of Germany were once more united. The mood took hold of Soviet Russia, where the political system collapsed, as it did in all the remaining countries of Eastern Europe. I ended my account of the First World War with the words, "We all hope for a better future. It must be better." Has such a future come? For many of the people who live on our earth, it is still remote. Among the constantly growing populations of Asia, Africa, and South America, the same misery reigns that, until not so long ago, was accepted as normal in our countries as well. We have no easy remedies, not least because there too, as ever, intolerance and misery go hand in hand. And yet, improvements in sending information have made the consciences of richer nations a little more attentive. Whenever an earthquake, a flood, or a drought in a far-off place leaves many victims, thousands of people in wealthier countries put their money and their efforts into providing relief. And that, too, used not to happen. Which proves that we still have the right to go on hoping for a better future. This concludes the reading of A Little History of the World by E. H. Gombrich.